Hey folks, Scott Weingart here, and this is the MCRIT Podcast. Today we have a story that's going to blow you off your feet. So good. Before we get there, let me just say that if you want to win a free registration to the SMAC conference in Chicago, you know, the best conference in the world for critical care and resuscitation, then you should do a Petra Kucha video on the subject of equipment. If you don't know what I'm talking about, come on over to smac.net.au or mcrit.org/133 and just click on the links and you will understand that if you make a video, you can win a free registration to SMAC. But let's get to the topic of our discussion today. In a previous podcast episode, I told you about REBOA. I had Megan Brenner on to discuss it. It is a potentially life-saving procedure that can be done percutaneously at the bedside of a sick trauma patient. And you might have said, wow, that's real interesting, Weingart, but why are you putting this on the podcast? We'll never be doing that. We're not vascular surgeons. I don't know how many trauma surgeons are listening to this podcast. How you doing, Leon? But you might be saying, well, but that's of only academic interest. It's nice to know what's happening, but I'm not going to be doing it, am I? Well, the answer is you probably should start thinking you may be doing it, because guess what? It can be done in the pre-hospital arena with no support staff, just some very good pre-hospital doctors and paramedics making it happen at the scene of a multi-trauma. So what we have today is an interview with the doctor who performed the first pre-hospital REBOA. But before we talk to him, the man who did it at the scene, we should talk to the man behind the man. And so the first part of this interview is with Gareth Davies, the medical director of London HEMS, one of the best helicopter EMS services in the world. Let's go right to Gareth.
Well, my name is Dr. Gareth Davies. I'm a consultant in emergency medicine and pre-hospital care at the Royal London Hospital in Whitechapel in the UK. And I'm also the medical director of London's Air Ambulance.
At what point did you folks start contemplating that pre-hospital REBOA or even ED REBOA would be possible, much less a good idea?
Yeah, it's a good question. Actually, it really does go back quite a long way. When I first started here back in 93, we were actually undertaking a form of REBOA back in those days when patients got to the resuscitation room and they were in a peri-arrest situation. We did have some very ad hoc attempts at REBOA back in those early days, but it was a time when ATLS was doing cut downs and we were doing lots of cut downs for venous access. And it was part of the ED regimen, but it wasn't, as you can imagine, back in those days, that regimented, that organized, and it ostensibly fell into a little bit of disrepute in so much it didn't seem to have an effect. And it was always done pretty much when the patients were dying and they were mortally wounded. And then it really wasn't until probably 2.5-3 years ago where we started to look at our data on pelvic fractures, and particular pelvic fractures that were arriving to us shocked. And the high mortality rate those patients had. You know, we were seeing 40%, maybe more, of those patients having a cardiac arrest before they got to theater or before they got to interventional radiology. And our mortality hadn't improved. So we were really sort of churning through things, trying to think about what we could do different, where we could do it different, and ostensibly that was the origins of the project. And perhaps one of the drivers here in the UK was that we were suddenly starting to see significant numbers of cyclists that were a growing phenomenon here in London that were displaying these typical sort of fractures, really bad fractures of their pelvis and their legs, that were just exsanguinating to death all the time. So that was the background, and we started the project, and I was the project lead for the ED and pre-hospital REBOA.
How do you go about training up your service to make this happen? It's a complex procedure. In most places right now, it's reserved in the hands of surgeons. And these are now ED and pre-hospital retrieval doctors doing it. How did you create a training program, and tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, we decided to take the step that we weren't going to train just a few exclusive people that were very senior, that once we decided it was a reasonable technique and the patients needed it, we really set about making sure that we trained everyone that would be on that shift to do it. So for the ED, Reboa, that started off as training consultants to do the procedure. And then because the pre-hospital response is a mixture of consultants and some senior registrars, we had to train up all of the registrars and flight paramedics to do it. And you have to train everybody because you're trying to deliver it as part of your service. So, it can't be a sort of showboating procedure where just one or two people who happen to be on duty when the right patient comes into hospital gets the technique. It has to be a sort of system-wise approach. So we decided from a training point of view to put a good governance package around it, which stemmed from a core SOP, standard operating procedure, that defined what should be done and how it should be done, which was backed up by resource files that included a lot of the papers that have been written about Reboa. We have our own low-tech mannequin for practicing the procedure. We set up moulages that each person that undertook the procedure would have to pass. There was a question and answer paper that people had to sit, and then they had to go through a viva with one of the seniors of the groups to see that they were signed off. So quite a sort of comprehensive collection of tools to make sure that in the end, whoever's on duty had been signed off to do it.
That's fantastic. I guess the last question I'd ask you, sir, is should this become standard care in big trauma centers in their ED by emergency physicians and by pre-hospital doctors?
Yeah, I think this technique, given time, will become a standard technique for emerging physicians. We're sort of early on the path here. We're obviously only doing zone three with plans to move to zone one eventually. But I think without a doubt that it will be a core skill in time of emergency physicians, anaesthetists, and trauma surgeons, and that includes the pre-hospital brigade.
Okay, so now you've heard where the vision came from, the planning, the training, Gareth Davies, Medical Director of London HEMS. Now let's talk to the doc that actually was on scene and performed the first pre-hospital Reboa.
So my name's Johnny Price. I am an anaesthetist normally, trainee in London, and I am doing a year of pre-hospital medicine at the moment. So I've just finished flying with London HEMS, and I'm currently flying with Essex and Hertfordshire Air Ambulance.
Fantastic. Now, as far as I'm aware, you are the first practitioner to place a pre-hospital Reboa on a trauma patient. Is that true?
That's true as far as I'm aware too.
Yeah, that's pretty incredible. So that's what we wanted to talk to you about today. Let's get to the actual case. So what were you guys called out for and what do you find when you get there?
So we were on the helipad and we got a call through, which came through from the police, which was about an incident in West London. And it was a 30-year-old or man in his 30s who'd been seen to fall from the top of a multi-story car park. And that's all the information that we had. We had about a 10 or 11 minute flying time, landed pretty close. And from the overhead, we could see the car park, which this chap had fallen off, which was five stories. And he'd fallen onto a sort of a tarmac concrete road below. But we landed pretty close, came up to assess him, and paramedics were already on scene. Police were already on scene, and there were some fireys already on scene as well. So primary survey-wise, his airway was okay. He was pretty tachypneic. He had a SATS probe on, but his SATS were unrecordable on sort of high-flow oxygen. Had a very, very faint radial pulse. heart rate of about 130 on the monitor, and the last systolic was sort of reading in the 60s, 70s. And neurologically, he sort of had his eyes open, certainly wasn't awake, was just about able to verbalize. I think I scored his formal GCS at 12. And then sort of bigger picture stuff, both of his feet were sort of above the level of his head, if you like, and he had pretty obvious bilateral open calcaneal fractures when we first turned up, and an obvious open sort of right ankle fracture and a right humeral fracture. Yeah, so that's what sort of met us to start with.
So this is a pretty critically ill multi-trauma patient. So I imagine you did all the standard resuscitation stuff. Did you folks make the decision to intubate him right off the bat?
So what we did, that particular day, there were two doctors flying. So I was actually supervising one of a new doctor to HEMS, but Simon Walsh is a very experienced emergency consultant. He's been an emergency consultant in the Royal London for the last 8 years, but was doing a secondment with London HEMS at the time, and one paramedic. So we did simple things first. So a bit of ketamine and midazolam in terms of sedation, just so that we could pull everything out to length and actually have a proper look at him and do some packaging. So he got his legs brought down from above his head, by which point it was pretty easy to examine his pelvis, and you know, his ACEs were obviously asymmetrical, and he had evidence of a vertical shear pelvic fracture. So we got on and started doing the bog standard stuff that we do in terms of packaging, so pulling things out to length, putting them on a scoop, all that sort of stuff. We carry blood in London, so we started a blood transfusion as well. And in the meantime, Simon got on the phone to Prof Lockie, who's a consultant on call. So our SOP, this chap basically fulfilled all the requirements for sort of code red and for pre-hospital blood. And one of the elements of the SOP is that we are advised or asked to speak to the duty consultant on call when we're doing that, because that's obviously a good marker for these being some of our sickest patients. And as part of that phone call, Reboa was discussed. And again, with the SOP for Reboa, we are advised to make a consultant phone call prior to the procedure. And especially given that this was the first one, we were very, very happy to do that. So we got him packaged, got him on a trolley, got the blood going, and then we sort of split roles. So Simon Walsh, who's the other doctor, and the paramedic, a chap called Gary Verdon, basically did a ROC-only RSI after the patient had had, I think, 2 milligrams of midaz and 40 milligrams of ketamine, and was pretty flat by that point. And I got on into the Reboa at the bottom end. And we'd flown through a pretty squally shower. It was a sort of a spring day in London, if that makes sense.
So, it does.
So it was quite interesting. So the environmental things were quite a challenge. So it's pretty breezy. We'd flown through a sort of cloud burst, so the floor was pretty damp and there were quite a lot of puddles around us. But subsequent to that, the sun had come out and was pretty bright. And that all sort of led to extra things which made the procedure a bit more challenging, just in terms of doing kit dumps when there's puddles on the ground, in terms of reflection off the ultrasound screen from the sunshine, all that sort of stuff. So we're pretty choosy about where we do our kit dumps for RSIs, and we're sort of mindful of sunshine and all that sort of standard stuff. But obviously this is a learning process with regards to Reboa, and one of the sort of London HEMS things that we're very keen on is getting 360 degree access to patients anyway. So we only very, very rarely do anything in the back of an ambulance or in the back of a helicopter. We try and do it all outside where we can get on and do stuff. But that did make it a bit more difficult in terms of the environmental things, just for dealing with glare and that sort of stuff.
Walk us through the entire procedure. And you can't be too specific, Johnny. Here on MCRIT, we love to hear everything you could think of in terms of how it actually took place.
Okay. So in terms of the Reboa procedure itself, so as I was saying, it happened sort of contemporaneously with the RSI. So I was assisted by a mixture of pilots. So we fly with two pilots and police officers, basically. So I set myself up. I'm right-handed. I set myself up on the right-hand side of the patient, as I would do normally for a groin line. We have a sonosite ultrasound machine, so I delegated holding that to one of the police officers. So that was opposite me. And the patient had been packaged with a pelvic splint as part of our initial stuff. So we got the Rubella kit out, which lives in a little yellow bag. So that's down by my right-hand side, by my right knee on the ground. So we've got all the kit sort of pre-prepared and ready to go. And in terms of what we did first, it's a question of trying to localize the target vessel as much as anything else. So went through the anatomy, trying to find the femoral artery by landmark. And this is where it gets really challenging because, as you can imagine, there's not an awful lot to feel in a patient like this. So it's sort of guesstimating where you think you're going to be going, put the ultrasound probe on, and then start looking. And I think I was pretty mindful that this was the first time this has been done, and I wanted to make sure that I got it in the right vessel. And the ultrasound was really tricky, to be perfectly honest. And that's, I think, one of the takeaway lessons. And having heard some of the sort of morbidity and mortality meetings of other Rubella cases, which have been done within the emergency department at the Royal London, there have been consultant radiologists who've not been able to get lines in because these patients are so shut down. So if you think of what you're classically taught in terms of arteries being pulsatile and non-compressible and all that stuff, none of that applied, to be perfectly honest. So the vessel itself, the only target vessel, I normally put my groin lines in a bit more distal just for cleanliness as much as anything else. So I'm quite happy sort of dealing a little bit further down the side. Put the probe on where I thought I should be going for common femoral artery. Couldn't really see anything. So basically moved the transducer up and down and around to try and find a pulsatile vessel that looked like a potential target. Identified what I could, which was probably about half a centimetre across. It was about 4 centimetres down. It was compressible, but I could see a vein that was pretty collapsed next to it, and put flows on and all that sort of stuff just to make sure in my own mind that I was, you know, aiming for what I should be aiming for. I did a lot of that actually with a blanket over my head and the ultrasound screen, just because without it, you'd got so much glare off the screen, you couldn't actually see anything. So yeah, that's an interesting lesson. And then having identified that we had a target, did our normal standard stuff. So we got a big blue drape that we basically put over the bottom half of the patient to try and maintain some degree of sterility. We've got sterile gloves on. Again, interesting issue, breezy day, big blue drape. It's fine in theatre, it's not a problem, but it tends to blow around quite a lot on windy days. So delegated somebody just to hold that still for us. And then went ahead with the procedure itself. So we have a standard sort of access kit. So I think it's a 20-gauge needle that we use off the top of my head. And under direct vision, cannulated the femoral artery. Got a good flashback of quite sort of red pulsar blood, which is obviously reassuring. Wire in. And then put our access sheath down through that. So we use a sort of... it's a similar sheath to what you'd use for a PA line, basically. So put that on, put that in. That all went fine, no problem. Obviously reassuring that you can aspirate nice sort of bright red blood. So that's all good. And then through that, we put in a long, stiff Amplatz guide wire, which is 145 centimetres long. So we feed that so that there's basically... about 100 centimetres, we put 50 centimetres in, 100 centimetres out of the patient, pretty much. So the sort of easy way of guesstimating it is it's about level with the patient's feet, the distal end of the wire. I should say with all of this, I was being watched on an iPhone, so Prof Lockie had FaceTimed in so he could see everything that was actually happening in real time. She didn't add any pressure whatsoever. And then after having done that, was still quite happy. I ultrasounded the wire in the vessel just to double check that I was happy with where it was. And then we used an embolectomy catheter as a Rubella balloon, basically. So loaded that over the top of the wire, having checked the balloon first, obviously, and inserted that. So we inserted that 40 centimetres at the skin, which basically takes it up into the sort of distal aorta. inflated the balloon, having checked the monitor beforehand just to try and get a ballpark figure of where we are and what's going to happen. Because in a lot of the training, you're obviously going to increase the SVR massively as soon as that balloon goes up. And if it doesn't, if you don't have physiological change, then you need to be very aware of where that balloon is and whether you're actually, venous or arterial, and you need to take the balloon down pretty quickly. So put the balloon up. Blood pressure started to drift up a little bit. There was nothing sort of dramatic, I wouldn't say. So in the teaching, they talk about, patients suddenly sitting up and being more awake because they're surrogating more. This guy had obviously been paralyzed and had a tube down already and had a degree of anesthetic, so that wasn't an issue with it. But, put the balloon up, and then we just gently withdraw the embolectomy catheter to about 24, 25 centimeters of the skin, just so it sits at the bifurcation. And it's supposed to sort of come back with the pulsatile flow that's in the distal aorta, and it did that a little bit. So pulled it back to about 25 centimeters, got a little bit of resistance, so stopped. By this point, we'd had a couple of blood pressures, which had started to sort of arrest any falling and had started to slightly turn the corner. And then really secured everything in place. We obviously had lots of other sort of contemporaneous activity going on, so we were still having blood transfusion going. And by this point, the endotracheal tube had been secured. He was on a ventilator, and the final bits of the packaging were being sorted, and we were sort of making a plan for what happened next. So we then leave in the Amplatz guide wire and the embolectomy catheter and just secure them all down, and we suture in the sheath so it can't go anywhere. And then with a fairly big sense of relief that it had all gone okay, things seemed to be looking the right way, we basically finished off our packaging and then wheeled the patient back towards the aircraft. When we have code red patients, and nowadays when we have Reboa patients, we always pre-alert them so that they can obviously get things ready for us. And you get a different response once you arrive there in terms of personnel and all that sort of stuff. So we made those phone calls, loaded into the back of the aircraft, and flew back.
Johnny, that's an incredible story. Let me ask you, how long do you estimate it took from first needle touch to the skin till you had it successfully inflated?
I think it was probably about 20 minutes, 25 minutes, something like that.
All right. Well, I guess the last question then is, anything you would do differently on your next Reboa in the field?
Yes, I think as an individual and as a service, we've obviously learned quite a lot. So we have a pretty robust clinical governance program that happens at London HEMS anyway. And this has obviously been through that process in terms of what we call death and disability meetings, which are our sort of twice weekly case review meetings. It's also been through a hospital morbidity and mortality meeting. And as well as that, I have done, along with all the team who were on that day, so all the clinical team and the pilots, we've done a reflective piece. And that's both on the technical aspects, but also, I think, really importantly, on the non-technical things as well. So there's lots of, little things, the environmental things that we can learn, things like getting glare screen stuff for the ultrasound, thinking about how we organize the kit so it's easier to get to, thinking how we number stuff so you have, Reboa is something which only very small people are familiar with. And when you're getting people to assist you who feel unfamiliar or don't know the kit, that's a challenge. That's trying to make stuff as easy as possible when you're doing it infrequently. But I think the bigger picture is about making sure all the other stuff happens so that, as we've just talked about, your scene times don't prolong unnecessarily. And I think, this is always going to take longer because it's the first time round. I think it's a confidence thing. I think we will learn, just to go with it. I think another key question is about when you bail out, if you're struggling, because the anatomy is difficult. These are incredibly sick patients, and it is easy to get task focused in this sort of situation. And if you spend an extra 20 minutes on scene and can deliver an intervention that's potentially saves a life, that's one thing. If you spend 20 minutes trying to do a procedure which then you have to abandon, that's a completely different kettle of fish. So you have to be pretty clear in terms of who's running the overall scene, who keeps an eye on the clock and keeps an eye on the overall scene management, as it were.
So what happened to the patient?
So the patient was basically, in terms of injuries, had a number of things, so all compatible with the sort of mechanism of injury that described. So the patient had an aortic transection just distal to their left subclavian artery, which was stented immediately. They did indeed have the vertical shear pelvic fracture that we were expecting. And in IR, they basically had embolization of multiple bleeding points for their right internal iliac artery. Lots of rib fractures bilaterally with, you know, underlying lung contusions and the open sort of long bone injuries that we talked about, so the humerus, the calcaneum, and the both ankles. But actually, he's done remarkably well. So he was on the intensive care unit for 9 days. He was in hospital for a total of 10 weeks. And actually, the patient's now been discharged into the community for further rehab and is, you know, neurologically completely normal and really has every chance of actually getting back to a, you know, a normal life, as it were. So I think hopefully a really good save.
Johnny, this has been fantastic. I can't thank you enough for coming on. And I'm sure the listeners are going to love this story. Well, there you go. If you're not inspired, then you are basically dead inside and you should retire. Scott Weingart for the MCRIT podcast saying bye-bye.